Hello and a warm welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, of professionals, of investors, of philanthropists, who are disruptors, yet not in your face. In each episode, I speak to one such leader, talking to her or him or them about their professional journeys, about their turning moments, about their turning points and pivot moments, and of course, the little joys of life and work. Unusual Suspect streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Google Podcasts, YouTube Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of podcast streaming platforms and directories. This conversation is taking place at a time, at a very interesting time of world history. We all know what's happening in West Asia. All of us, particularly leaders across business and world leaders and governments, have constantly one eye on what's happening on the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, the passage of vessels passing through the Strait of Hormuz have considerably slowed down. And if this continues to persist for a longer period of time, it'll have consequences all across the world and also, of course, India's domestic economy. To talk about all of these and much more, I have someone who knows it and has been tracking these as part of his professional life, like the back of his palm. I have with me Anu Ratninde, business leader, board member, advisor, who has been at the forefront of all of these for more than three decades now, leading business transformation across Asia, Europe, and the United States. As a former president of Asia Pacific of Johnson Controls and Aptiv, he has had a ringside view and a front row seat leading complex business transformation and strategic reinvention across sectors and geographies. Welcome to the show, Anu. Delighted to have you here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Anu, let's start off with a very fundamental question. And, you know, it's about India and understanding India. In your view, what do you think that leaders fundamentally misunderstand about India?
I think to me, the biggest thing that people fundamentally misunderstand is that India is the next China. Mm-hmm. India is going to be same growth story that China started about two decades ago. And I think fundamentally they misunderstand the deep roots of India, the uniqueness of India, and the history that built that for 6,000 years. Right. The importance of being here, living here, breathing here, and understanding that, it's missing.
That's right. You know, it's interesting. It's an interesting point you make that we fundamentally try to compare ourselves with being the next China. So we are rather an aspirational China instead of being an India itself. You talk about India 1.0 and India 2.0. What is it that really matters, and who's stuck in the old playbook?
I think if you look at for many Western leaders and because of the Western leaders that Eastern leaders follow, so some of the leaders from the Asia have the same mindset as well, thinking, hey, all what we're chasing is growth. So we like our business to grow, we like our GDP to grow. So of course India will grow. And that's probably common. That's common for any economy that is growing. Mm-hmm. But what is different is how. Mm-hmm. And how we do that. So in India 1.0, that is probably, let's say, up until 10, 15 years ago. So India was a relatively smaller in terms of scale and right. What any companies did it. It's all about, hey, let's go in with a very lean capital and bring in the products and technologies from elsewhere. It doesn't have to be led within the country, and it can be managed from Asia headquarters, whether it's in Singapore, right. Hong Kong, or from the US, and go very lean, low price, just good enough products with the low quality, and serve that market. And from there, that has fundamentally shifted to a market that it defines by itself. with a very uniqueness way, and that requires a strategic commitment to do that.
Right.
To do that, you need the institutional power to do that. You need the right level of governance and compliance and a strategic focus to do that. The companies who do that will be successful. I want to give you one example. Somewhere in the time frame, maybe around 2015, I was given a business on Asia Pacific business to run. It's about $3 billion business on Asia Pacific. The size of business in India was $40 million, which is nothing in the size of the Asia Pacific business. I could have spent all my time in China and Japan and Korea and all those big markets and on automotive industry. And my task given was to shut down the Dharuhera plant and Chennai plant and consolidate that into the Pune plant. So three plants becoming one.
Right.
And I asked for time, being the new guy, hey, give me some time. The response I get is, hey, all your predecessors said that, you know, but they didn't make any change. The growth never came. But instead, I came and I lived here. I worked with the team and built that. And instead of, you know, making these different PowerPoints and making the assumptions and letting spreadsheets manage it versus living and breathing the team, I just met the team. And that business today is $600 million with seven manufacturing plants.
Right.
That was only possible, the understanding, living, and building that leadership, the building that institutional power, building that compliance and governance, and empowering team to do that.
But tell me, to be honest, how big is it a mistake to follow the China playbook in India in terms of, say, let's try and give a multiple to it, that we are, how are we actually reducing the potential if we are doing that? And why do, as a corollary to that, why do companies keep on doing that?
I think there is, if you look at any company or any leader, so there is two opposing powers that is required. One, we call it, it's the ambidexterity, that there is a strong power for the global alignment.
Right.
The global alignment is coming from the culture, the heritage, and the administrative heritage, how they have been led and how they have been managed, and some experiences they had in their life. Those experiences could be decade or three decades, four decades old, but they define that. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is. But then the local flexibility, that's the market, that the how local markets change and evolve and all that, these are two opposing forces. Mm-hmm. So the local markets demand local flexibility and the driver need to, and the headquarters want to manage global alignment. Question is, where is that equilibrium? Where is that equilibrium? How much you're going to allow to have that local flexibility and treating the strategic market versus we're trying to apply the same playbook? So it's a hard mindset. Actually, I mean, if you do a 2x2 matrix on that, global alignment high-low and the local flexibility high-low, so you can have sometimes whether it's global, multinational, transnational type of mindsets that's created, because where do you plot yourself?
Mm.
So companies very difficult to overcome that administrative heritage because the headquarter power, sometimes the CEOs can't even fight that. Because they're being surrounded by people, oh, I know India, I know China.
So it's as much a socio-historical subject as much a business subject too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it does, because if you look at many, the short tenures that CEOs have, unfortunately, that we see on the Western world on a statistics level. So then the time for them to overcome these battles is limited.
Mm-hmm.
So then their focus is quickly going into something.
Absolutely.
So I have seen in China, for example, that's doing business in China for 30 years and living there, there are many Western companies came in. They brought in sometimes a lot of expatriates. They have ceremonial visits from the headquarters, but they live in fancy places in downtown and fancy restaurants, go back. But they never embrace. And they announce, hey, we exit China. Because it's not our focus market. Same thing happened in India.
Right.
Look, all the multinational, the automotive companies, and they exit India. I mean, I couldn't believe some of the companies like General Motors and so on, then they exit. I'm sure they had reasons because they came into a level where they don't know how to manage it anymore.
Absolutely.
So exit was the right answer for the short term.
Right. And you have led across India, China, Southeast Asia, and of course, Europe and the US. What is it that one strategy that worked remarkably well in one geography failed in another?
I think it's fundamentally thinking it is the same. I'll have another example I can say. Like in a Western world and anywhere, when you look at a KPI, you can say, hey, the attrition level. In order for you to have a high-quality manufacturing plant, so you need to have an attrition level low so you have a stable workforce. So we were used to seeing, like in China, for example, we have attrition levels of 7%, 8%, and in the U.S. is lower, Europe, and so on. So, and when I had a plant in Pune, attrition level was 20%. And even I went through that. I tried so hard to reduce that attrition.
Right.
For 6 years, I failed. I failed reducing that attrition because there's a lot of people coming first-time employments and coming from farms, and after a while, they have family reasons to go back and so on. So today that plant has 15,000 people, and the plant revenue is about $300 million, $300-$400 million. And still the attrition is 20%. But the margins is very acceptable. It's above average margins because that was something we were not able to fix.
Right.
It's a wrong matrix because that somehow the societal has that thing. So, but then what our operation leaders did is they designed the manufacturing line that can't tolerate the high attrition.
Absolutely.
Because high attrition was not something we were able to fight. But in the global standards, we try to drive the same number.
You know, You have often said that India cannot be managed but can only be led. I mean, that's easier said than done because it's a far more complex phrase than it sounds like. How does it play out in a boardroom where decision making has to take place?
I think it's very often the discussion's going to be like I mentioned earlier, India is next China.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever we did in China, let's go and apply. So let's send expatriates, so let's find somebody to go. And then we manage, we do weekly reviews, monthly reviews, and we have multiple people, functions, and all that doing their own thing, and then they fix it. So that was like a treating India is like any other outpost small business. So, and then we manage it. We try to manage. We apply the same playbook that worked in any other country. So for that to come out and seeing the true potential that India is going to bring in and with the talent level, the culture level, the opportunity level, the understanding that and building the right institutional capabilities, right leadership, right empowerment to do that. And that is very unique. So it's very difficult to absorb because many leaders who are very successful have never done that. Because it worked in the past.
Hmm.
If you look at the technology space, for example, in the past, what technology bringing from the U.S., it worked. But today, these countries do demand their uniqueness. Back in early 2000, I was designing the electronic engine control module for Mr. Ratan Tata's 1 lakh car, very famous 1 lakh car. It's not a question of whether 1 lakh car is successful or not, but what Mr. Ratan Tata, the vision that he brought in, we do need innovation, products, design capabilities for India in India.
Right.
And that is very unique. That's very visionary thinking. And as someone who have gone through that project as an engineer at that time, I mean, it was in my head. It's not about bringing in the production technologies elsewhere, that this market do demand that. And I have now been into I met many government leaders and industry leaders. They're demanding much more technologies that the world doesn't have. The quality levels, the delivery, the speed of delivery, that has to be understood here. It's no longer like the same theory and the concept that work elsewhere will work because these are emerging markets.
Absolutely.
That concept doesn't work.
You know, let's talk a little bit about complexity. And you often say that leaders often get it wrong because they're trying to controlling it rather than trying to navigate it. Help us understand this. How does it work?
Well, the complexity is a big science, right? So oftentimes people use the word complexity to show it's difficult. That's not the scientific definition of it. Complexity, the scientific definition in the simplest form, is that once the elements interact, interdependent, learn, adapt, and evolve, the situation always changing, and as a result, you can't predict. It's not a machine that there's a formula to do that.
Absolutely.
So in reality, every human being is complex. Every organization is complex. Every human interaction is complex. So, however, over the last 60 years or so, there's many leadership theories and many formulas came how to teach leaders how to manage. And that kind of replaced thousands of years of history that we inherited in Asia, what truly leadership is. Like, for example, about 2,600 years ago, Sun Tzu wrote a book called Art of War.
Right.
The Art of War, Sun Tzu being fought.
Yeah.
There he said, if you know yourself, know your enemy, you need not worry about 100 battles.
Right.
So what fundamentally trying to say is, it's about knowing yourself, knowing others. Reality is how difficult. Today they converted to SWOT analysis, and it's the same thing, strength and weakness of yours and opportunities and threat of others. But how difficult to know that? Because we had this deep thinking, and the history tells us the importance of managing yourself. To me, the real complexity, because the outcome is unpredictable, you're not trying to manage others. You're trying to manage yourself. Every opportunity is for you to manage. Organization is the shadow of the leader.
Right.
Therefore, if you want to change organization, you change yourself. The system's thinking, understanding the outcome is uncertain, accepting the interconnectivity and the power around it, and then the internalizing, truly true to your value system, why you want to be a leader, and then how you interact with people, learn and adapt, that whole process of managing yourself in order to navigate through complexity and embrace complexity.
Absolutely.
Instead of try to simplify it.
You know, your SILLA framework, S-I-L-L-A framework, kind of challenges the traditional leadership models. Do you believe that the old leadership models have fully broken? And how does SILLA address those?
Well, in the SILLA model, fundamentally, it doesn't teach you how to manage others.
You're right.
Because I don't believe in managing others.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in managing myself.
Right.
Like, very simple thing, like start meeting on time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how many leaders today complain that people don't come to meetings on time?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be surprised how many people complain that people don't come into. But I never had that problem because I am never late to a meeting.
Yeah.
And people do realize I don't wait for anyone either.
Yeah.
I do, because I'm not punishing those who come on time for someone who didn't come. So if the leader behaves that, the organization will follow.
Yeah.
So the fundamental difference between the SILA leadership operating model and any other theory is, when I'm not managing others, I'm managing yourself.
Right.
I'm helping leaders finding out who they are, helping understand why you want to be a leader, and then make that commitment. It comes down to two things: having the right mindset and getting the little things that matters the day and night.
Yeah.
So the leaders misunderstand how important are the little things. The who you hire,
right,
who you fire, everyone is observing. Everyone is observing how leaders behave, what they dress, how they eat, how they come, how they do. People are observing. And then the organization naturally changed. They don't follow the rules.
Absolutely.
They don't follow the rules. I mean, someone at Confucius Theory said, if the prince is good, you don't need rules. People are good. Mm-hmm. If the prince is bad, government can come up with rules. Nobody will follow.
Absolutely.
So it's very true for any organization.
Tell us something about your own. You have gone through a pivot moment, if I may say so, during your career. Having reached a certain level, you decided to give it all up and take a different way of trying to be a mentor and trying to set up companies. You have set up companies, grown them, and also given them all up for different reasons. Tell us something about it, and what keeps you excited and motivated now?
Thank you for the question. And I was born and raised in Sri Lanka, and I started my early career in Singapore, then from US, Hong Kong, Switzerland, and past 10 years in China. And I I worked for three companies, but I had 18 bosses along the way and managed very large businesses at the Fortune 500 C-suites at the highest levels and managing 30, 40, 50,000 people and multi-billion dollar businesses. And at the age of 56, at the highest earning power, that's normal for senior executives, and so much more to go and with full of energy and a runway in front of me, I could have gone. I could go and do that again. In India, I had three businesses. One business is I grew more than 10 times. Other business is about 5 times. Other business about 6 times. I could go and do it again. I could continue my job. I could go another company do it. Or I, instead of focusing on one, I could be broader, give that. Like your show says, it's an unusual suspect. I want to be unusual. If I look at all my career, I felt, if I reflect, I've been unconventional. And I want to keep that. And today, that's why I research about why leaders behave like it's a dangerous place to be and depressed and stressed and so on and destroy organizations, versus some leaders really make the whole society and the world better around them, with they're still smiling and happy. So I did research on this question and I wrote a book and that is very well received. And I've been talking and approaching and coaching many organizations and CEOs. I feel the value of sharing that knowledge is much more purposeful than I'm going and doing myself, because then my focus is narrow. That's my focus is going to be, like you say, it's going to be unusual.
Very true and very well said. And, you know, finally, we are living in a very uncertain world, and more than uncertain, it's also become very unpredictable. It's very difficult to anticipate what's going to happen in a few weeks from now. Given this context and given the circumstances that we find ourselves in, what is that one capability or one attribute that leaders cannot just afford to ignore?
I think it's a very important. We were privileged in Asia. We learned mindfulness a long time ago. We sometimes tend to forget and we chase different things. But I think it's so important to live in the presence. It's more very, very important to get the little things right that supposed to be done today.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't get it right, that is supposed to get it done right now, with having your body and mind together, there is no chance of getting those big things right. It's always uncertain world. I think, I mean, I've been 30 years in a corporate world. I don't remember any quarter that I started saying this quarter is going to be easy. This month is going to be easy. This year budget is easy. This month, this customer project delivery is easy. This supplier will deliver me on time. This is all about uncertainty.
Absolutely.
Right? It's every time, like you said, there was a time that I almost don't want to watch news after work, because every time I watch news, I feel like somewhere a crisis, which ultimately will impact my supply chain and I won't be getting products to my factories and I won't be able to deliver to customers. So that's the real world we live in. But what is important is to be here now, keep your body and mind together, and then do the little things that matters the most in life and at work.
Absolutely. Get the little things right, get the big things right. Thank you so much, Anu, for taking the time out and dropping by to have this conversation with us and sharing your deep insights and perspective on a range of issues.
Thank you very much, Gaurav. It's great to be with you.